You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas that are shaping our patterns of consumption for the better. I'm your host, Stefan Engo. Julie Nguyen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
You're the co-founder of Methodology. Hey, by the way, you moved to Los Angeles. Welcome.
Yeah.
Was it a year ago or so?
Yeah, it was about a year ago. I love it here. Everyone thinks it's super weird that I moved down here because my business is based up north, but the food scene down here is so incredibly inspiring. Like I have to be where the good food is because it's what inspires me and gives me tons of ideas. And so I'm here, but it's also obviously a weird time to be here now. Like, I moved down here to go to all the restaurants, and now, like, they're basically, like, most of them are closed. So it's...
All right. I know, yeah. A lot of them have, like, meal kits that you can take home, or you can do some pickup, curbside pickup type of situations. Have you been exploring that at all?
Oh, yeah, big time. It's so fascinating seeing what... For me, I like seeing what the high-end restaurants are doing for takeout, because... Like the attention to detail of fine dining when applied to basically the exact same context of the service that I do, which is food delivery, it's really interesting seeing how chefs change recipes or create new recipes that travel well, which was a constraint they didn't used to have. So yeah, I'm learning a lot right now and literally getting takeout every day just to see what chefs are doing.
Yeah, that must be some really good inspiration. Have you seen anything clever with that? Because I feel like so many things, anything that's liquid-based or something like that, that's going to get too soggy. Mm-hmm. Are people separating things? What are people doing that would, if you had any inspiration from that?
Yeah, the most impressed I've been so far for takeout was Vespertine. And it's been really cool seeing how that chef has learned from each menu he designed. So he basically iterated on his menu. And so the first week he was live, he did a couple simple dishes. I can't even remember. It was like chicken and something. And then every time he changes his menu, he improves because he's learning from the experience. So the experience I had just now was like a 10-course meal. Wow. Every single course came with a color-coded card that explained to you exactly what you were eating, right? Everything was like separated and plated beautifully. So you felt like you were getting a fine dining version of takeout. It wasn't just like a fine dining chef just giving you whatever he could cook, which is what a lot of the others are doing. Like he really made me feel like I was having an elevated experience at home. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever.
That's amazing. Do they just not do takeout normally?
No, they don't. And this is why it's so fascinating right now. A lot of the best restaurants like never normally do takeout because they're packed.
Right.
You know, the best restaurants in LA, you like, you're lucky if you get in.
And yeah. The experience is you have to be there to mm-hmm. do the... To get the full experience.
Exactly. And because their menus are designed to have food that tastes the best when it's served right out of the kitchen. And they don't want you to take it home and have a subpar experience because they're so particular about their food, right? Which makes sense when you put that much love into it. You don't want people eating it when it's 10% as good as it would be when it's fresh, right? So, but a lot of these restaurants now have no other option. And so they're pivoting to takeout, and in order to do that, they have to completely change their menu so that the food travels well. And so that's why I'm learning a lot right now from them. I'm loving it. It's really interesting seeing what they're doing.
Yeah, I live above a place in my apartment building that is a like molecular gastronomy type of place. And I wonder, I haven't looked at what they're doing, but they've got things that are foams and all that kind of stuff. That must be interesting. Some people have... You know, like stuff that's very, very high end sometimes can get weird if you go down the molecular gastronomy path where it's like, it's essentially you're eating a gas or something like that. Like something pops out of a bell and you have to breathe it in. I'm not sure how that travels.
Yeah. That's the thing. I don't normally actually like fine dining that much because a lot of times it's so weird. I appreciate the creativity of it. But it's never as comforting to me as just going to get like a really good burger, right? So the interesting thing about fine dining pivoting to takeout now is they're realizing that when people eat at home, like that change in context, people want something comforting, familiar. Like they can't. It's like the experience needs to be elevated, but the dishes need to be a little bit rustic and comforting. So they're figuring that out. That's something that we figured out a long time ago with our menu. It's like people want different things when they're at a restaurant versus when they're just eating at home with their family. It's just, it's a different, yeah, it's a different moment. So like more rustic comforting is what people want at home. And restaurants is when, yeah, you're willing to eat something weirder because you're going for the overall experience, not just the food. So
with methodology, you know, sometimes I struggle to describe it because it has elements of different kinds of food delivery services, because sometimes it seems like you have just straight up ingredients and there's some preparation involved. Some things don't really require any preparation at all. How do you describe it? How do you think about like putting that experience together for people?
Yeah, well, my vision for the product when we started was to just elevate the at-home eating experience, especially for busy professionals. Because I started the company when I was working in tech, working crazy hours, managing multiple teams. And I would get home from work sometime between 8 to 10 p.m. And like, I was tired and I wanted high quality food, but I didn't want to order takeout, but I wanted something that was like homemade quality, but that I could eat after 5 to 10 minutes of prep, and that just product didn't exist. And that's really what methodology is about. And that's why there's a whole range of food. It's meant to be really flexible and fit into your lifestyle based on what you feel like doing that day. So yeah, there's stuff that's fully ready to go, throw it on a pan in 5 minutes. There's stuff for the nights when you have a little bit more time and want to be more involved with the cooking. Like we have Wagyu steak fried rice kit that takes a little bit longer. But it's great if you actually want to do a little bit of cooking. And then there are things where you could just grab something and bring it to work and have like a buffalo chicken salad. So yeah, it's broad because the way people eat during the week changes, right? What they want on Monday is really different from what they want on Friday, which is different from what they want on Sunday. And so I'm designing the product for the full life cycle of how our core user experiences food throughout the week.
And do you think, because there's been so much going on in the food delivery area for several years, the companies like the Blue Apron and HelloFresh of the world, they're very focused on the sort of kit and putting this together. Do you feel like that's too narrow, or that you wanted to be able to have the flexibility to offer all those different options?
Yeah, I think for us, I do like to have something that's broader and not as narrow, because we're also not going after a mass market audience. So for us, we're going after the person who is really busy with work, but also really values high quality and sustainable ingredients. And sadly, in America, that's not the majority of the population. And so because we are already going after a niche audience, for us, the best way for us to grow is to actually make sure that they're using us regularly and they're using us all week long. So a lot of people who will use a Blue Apron, like Blue Apron will give you 2-3 meals that week, but our users are eating us for at least 5 meals each week. So we need to really think through what people are eating for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and how that changes every day. And we need to give them more variety, because we end up becoming a substitute for a grocery store a lot of weeks for our target audience.
I like that you've put a stake in the sand and said, you know, this is premium. Also, it's in Los Angeles, Seattle, or Southern California, Seattle, Portland, and that's it for now. And being very, I mean, I'm sure you're going to be expanding to more regions, but I think a lot of companies want to do everything for everyone too fast, too soon. And you're staying like fairly focused. And I think your users are more likely to really fall in love with what you're doing, I think, that way.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's a hard thing to do, because the users we're focused on, they are a much smaller group. But to your point, I feel like there's no one else playing in the space that we're in as far as the price points we're at. It ends up being about $20 a meal for a healthy meal. And yeah, there are a lot of meal kits and meal prep companies out there, and they're all playing in that $12 range. And that just doesn't align with the problems that I was trying to solve and the values that we have, because the quality of food that we want to use, the type of packaging we want to use, that cannot be done mathematically for $10 to $12. And so, yeah, we're going after someone who's like, hey, I'm willing to spend $8 more a meal to have something that has more sustainable ingredients and where the whole product design just has a greater attention to detail.
Yeah, you use those glass jars, and also just it's so beautiful. I feel like everyone has heard this from their mom or their grandma or someone or their dad, you know, who says like you got to eat all of the colors. When you see the methodology food, it's just so it's so appealing in every facet of it.
Thank you. It's so gratifying hearing that, because we really labor over color and variety, because we're a health focused company. So, I mean, the amount of time my co-founder Steven and I spend on designing each meal, like we do multiple 4-hour calls each week to go over the menu for the next week. The menu changes every week. So we're just constantly laboring over like, how do we introduce a new type of green here that they've never eaten before, or this meal needs something pickled and probiotic. And so because we spend so much time making sure the meals are balanced, they actually naturally end up being colorful. It looks like a beautiful like rainbow when you open your fridge and you just see this rainbow in jars. I love that look. I love that feeling that people get when they open their fridge and they're like, ah, like I'm all set for the week.
You mentioned, I just kind of want to do a little bit of a diversion, but you mentioned working in tech. I know you were at a company called Lumosity that I've used. I remember when Lumosity like first came out, it was like 10 years ago or more, right? It was like 12 years ago.
It was a while.
And I remember when it came out, it was such a big deal. These sort of brain games. And I feel like Sudoku was becoming popular or something around that time. I don't remember. See, maybe I wasn't enough of a Lumosity user because I don't even remember which one was the game that I used to play on there, which probably means my brain hasn't soaked in the necessary things that I was supposed to soak in. But what was that all about? Because I know that company, I mean, got huge amounts of funding and was doing really well, it seems like, for a while. I don't really know where it ended up or how you started or got involved with any of it.
Yeah, that's a funny thing. I was living in San Francisco at the time, and before I started working there, I was actually working at JP Morgan in finance. And like, you feel so lame in the Bay Area if you work in finance and not in tech. Like, I would go to parties and no one wanted to hear anything about my work.
Wow.
Which made sense. And I also didn't understand tech at all. So I was always confused when other people were talking about what they were working on. But I also thought it was inspiring. Like, wow, all my friends are building products that are actually helping people, and their products felt so tangible, and I had so much FOMO. So I ended up working at Lumosity. I interviewed at a bunch of tech companies and decided to go to a really small startup. I think that I was employee number like around 15, something like that, very early. And it was the greatest startup boot camp like I could have possibly asked for. Because I mean, at the time I got a job offer at Facebook, and I didn't go to Facebook because they felt so big to me at the time, which is crazy now.
Wow.
But I think that when I got an offer at Facebook, maybe they had like 800 or 1,000 people, I can't remember. And I thought that was too big.
Yeah.
And
big.
Yeah, I felt too big because I was like, I want to work for a startup because I knew that I wanted to start something someday. So I went to Lumosity, and it was great because I got to report directly to the CEO and literally learn how to build a product and a marketing team from the ground up. And I was there for 6.5 years. And by the time I left, I had learned so much about customer acquisition, product, you know, marketing. You're managing a management team even, because by the time I left, we had around 150 employees. So yeah, I learned a ton about tech, how to work with engineers and designers and all of that. And so when I ended up starting Methodology, because food was a real pain point for me at that point in my life, because I was just busy and I wanted to eat healthy. And I'm someone who, I have a background of health issues and food sensitivity. So I can't just eat willy nilly and be okay. Like, if I don't manage my diet, I get anxious, I get depressed, I gain weight super easily, I get acne. So I really had to manage my diet. And it was such a nightmare doing that, the busier I became with work. And I just saw that my friends felt the same. I looked around, I was around 30 at the time, and all my friends working in tech were working crazy hours, struggling to eat healthy. It just felt like there was no solution for this. It felt like you had to have this trade-off in your career where, you know, you're either going to like work really hard and crush it your job, or you're going to like be, you know, eat healthy and do all those other things. You couldn't really do both because it both take time, right? There's limited time in the day. So I ended up prototyping the idea. I didn't even think it would become a business. My co-founder and I just hired a personal chef and started providing meals to our friends who were interested. And the group kept growing and people kept asking to get added. And finally, after a couple months of doing it, we just decided to just take the plunge and go full time. And I quit my job, and which then led me to the scariest, hardest year of my life. But we can get into that later.
So many people, especially in Silicon Valley, have that kind of grueling commute going back and forth between San Francisco and down somewhere, Palo Alto, all those different places. Was that your case? Because I know that that just eats up. It feels like people are doing that, spending 2-3 hours in the bus or the car every day. That's crazy to me.
Oh my God. No, thank goodness I never had the commute. I don't think I'll never, I mean, that was probably one of the main reasons why I didn't take the job offer at Facebook, because I didn't want to leave San Francisco. Thankfully, I was just a quick bus ride to work every day. But still, like, even without the commute, hours at tech startups are crazy. I feel like, yeah, you know, the TV shows about it don't exaggerate for people who don't work in tech. It's like, it's long hours.
What did you take away from that experience that you still use today? I know that you were doing a lot of, because you were running the marketing side there at Lumosity, a lot of email campaign type of drip campaigns, mm-hmm, automation, all of that type of stuff. Like, what are the things, is that some of the stuff that you take away from Lumosity, or is it more, I don't know, strategic or meta? Where do you go with it?
Oh, there is, I mean, I worked there for 6.5 years, so I feel like I could probably talk for hours about what I learned there. So definitely, you know, definitely the marketing playbook on, you know, marketing automation, customer acquisition. Basically, like, what I specialized in there was lifecycle marketing. So when someone goes from never having heard of your brand before, how do you get them from that point to the point where they become a really, really loyal customer? Like, what does that journey look like? How does messaging have to change throughout that journey? Because you can't obviously, like, bombard someone with a ton of information right up front. You have to figure out the right time to introduce every new little juicy tidbit of information. So I did a lot of that there, which ended up being really helpful for launching methodology. And then also just, I started and worked with our first growth team there. So a team of engineers and designers. And that experience was really helpful because coming over and starting methodology, we obviously have a tech team here now. And if I hadn't learned how to do that, it would have been a totally new experience for me to figure out how to work efficiently with engineers and get like a really good software product built, so which was extremely helpful. Yeah.
Can you give some more specific examples of lifecycle marketing and how that, I don't know, things that you adjusted or shifted or things that you learned and didn't work? You know, there's so much information, and trying to figure out what are you saying at which point in the lifecycle, and also just how much automation are you doing to begin with? Because I think it really depends on the kind of company that you're at, how much you can really automate it. Because in your case right now, one thing that's nice is you have this quite focused audience. So in theory, you know, you probably are able to do more kind of performance marketing than other companies might be able to, because you can narrow in on that specific audience. And then, but are you able to kind of build out that whole flow with a lot of automation all the way through them becoming a loyal customer? Has that been a goal of yours, and have you been successful at that? Have you learned anything about what to optimize there?
Yeah, I mean, well, all of our marketing is automated. That's why our marketing team, like, still consists of one person plus me working on it a couple hours a week. So that's how efficient a marketing team can be.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's how efficient a marketing team can be once you really understand automation. So we basically have set up all our backend systems with engineering. So we built all custom reporting that's all cohort based. So any user that comes through our funnel from the moment that they first put in their email address to any point in time, like up till today, even if they've been with us for 5 years, we have such granular cohort based reporting. Like, I know what every user did, like, at every point in their journey, literally from whether they ordered that week to, like, what they ordered that week to how they rated their food that week to whether they referred a friend that week. And so because we have such good reporting, we can set up a lot of split tests easily and actually see whether we are driving the behavioral changes we want to see. So with us, we are looking to build long-term relationships with high-end customers and have really high-touch relationships. We're not a mass market product, right? We are We are more in the high end space. And so when we get a test going, we actually have to leave. We leave things on for a long time because we want to see like, okay, if we do this, then at day 60, 90, 120, is this person still engaging with us or have they dropped off? Have they stopped ordering? And so because we have that reporting set up, we can set up all different kinds of split tests on like, okay, should emails have videos? Did they have audio files? Should they be sent from me? Should they be mostly image heavy with photos of food? Like these are all kinds of things that we've tested over time to try to figure out what do people want to learn about from us? You know, how do they want to learn about it? When do they want to learn about it? And then change those up pretty regularly. So we're at the point now where we don't really mess around with the email drip as much anymore because we've been around for a couple of years. It's pretty optimized. And so now on the marketing side of things, we're starting to shift our focus more towards just creating a lot of good educational content for people and weaving that into the product experience itself. So that like if someone sees, for example, cacao mix on the website, they can click a link to a video and see video footage of me and Steven in Guatemala learning about where the cacao comes from, how it's fermented, how we created the recipes, why this stuff is good for you. So I feel like, you know, the marketing automation to me is, it's kind of the stuff when you set up a business, you got to just get that foundation set up in the first year or two. And then the beautiful thing about it is it is on autopilot. And then you can start to direct your resources towards the things that are, I don't want to say lower ROI, but like the payback from a lot of these educational, more brand things that I think about them is slower and longer than something like performance-based marketing. But once the performance-based marketing is set up, then you get to do the fun brand stuff where it's more about, you know, storytelling and just doing things because you know it's valuable to customers, even though it's not clear when or how it's going to pay itself back. And that's the kind of marketing I like more anyways, personally. So we're kind of in that phase of the business now where I'm not really like split testing things like crazy anymore on the automation side. And I'm more just thinking about what are the stories behind our food that we should be telling so that people understand all of the effort that goes into designing everything that makes it onto our menu.
And you're doing such a great job, I think, with Instagram in particular, having so many videos of you talking about all kinds of different things. Like I saw that you had one recently about COVID and being very, you know, open and transparent with your customers about how you're thinking about it, how you're incorporating new practices. Those are really, I think, insightful and personal. And also, I just want to know, like, how does travel factor into your whole lifestyle and how you run this company? Because you mentioned Guatemala. I saw you had a great video about going to Oaxaca, like a whole series about you going to the food markets there and kind of discovering things. Is it a method for you mostly for discovery and inspiration? Or how do you think of travel as part of you running this business?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think it's twofold. One, it's such an incredible way for me to learn about food. There are things that I've discovered during my travels that haven't really become mainstream in America yet. So, for example, in Oaxaca, that's when I really became really familiar with this chinchetle paste. That's the base of the Oaxacan chili oil that's now on our menu. And it took me a while to figure it out. I was eating at restaurants and there were certain dishes where I realized, okay, this sauce on this tastes better than anything like I've ever tasted before. Like, what is this? And so I had to ask around and talk to local foodies there. And I realized this paste is the base of so much Oaxacan food. And so I had a food tour guide take me deep into the market to find where some of these pastes are made. And I brought back a few bricks to the chefs in, you know, at our headquarters. And I said, listen, we got to like replicate this. There are some online recipes, but you know, we need to get this on the menu. We have to obviously tweak it because the Oaxacan version is very spicy and our customers can't eat that spicy. So like, we had to like methodology-ify it to make it a bit more accessible. But now like that paste is something that, I mean, it's so fun for me because I feel like I am blessed in that I can travel the world discovering things and then I can bring these foods back to our customers. Like a lot of our customers are moms with kids who are probably never going to go to Oaxaca, right? And so the fact that they can go into our pantry, know this is something that I fell in love with during my travels, be able to eat that, share it with their families, put it in their food, make everything tastier. Like, I live for that. I live for discovering new things and then sharing them with our customers. And that's, you know, that's really how travel factors in. But the second thing that I was going to mention is that travel, the travel part is just this bullet point in the way Stephen and I have chosen to run the business. Like, in year one, we were literally slaves of the business, where everything we did had to revolve around like making the business succeed. And we were willing to sacrifice anything in our lives to make that happen. And then at some point we realized like, hey, this isn't sustainable. So every year we step back at the beginning of the year and we each write out like, what do we want in our whole lives? Like not just in work, but in our whole lives, personal, financial, all that stuff, health. And then we share it with each other. And then we say like, how can we use methodology to help each of us like achieve those things this year? And so, so travel has always been a big thing for me. So Stephen is super supportive. Like he knows that like for me to be happy at methodology long-term, I need to be able to still continue to travel a lot and explore the world, even though I'm running this company. And so like he accommodates that. And like I never have to feel bad about wanting to go take a trip. I don't have to run it by him or anything. He just knows how much it means to me and how much it inspires me. And so I do it. And so I guess I'm sharing this because I know a lot of co-founders who don't run their businesses this way and think of their businesses as a tool to help them like really live their dream lives. And it's really worked out very nicely for Stephen and me. And it's one of the reasons why, like, no matter how hard things get, it actually makes us want to work harder because we know we have this tool that helps us do the things that we really want to do in life. Everything from the personal stuff to, frankly, just like sculpting the food world in the way we think it should be and the way it should function. And it just really motivates us. And we love what we do so much. And we love that methodology is a vehicle for us to live our dream lives, to shape the world the way we want. That, like, I don't know, I know I could see us running this business for decades. Like, I just can't imagine a world where either one of us is like, I'm over this now, I want to do something else, because of the fact that we do it this way.
And I had such a similar experience to you, because it took me a lot longer to figure it out, because Jesse and I have been running companies now together for like 11 years. And I think it wasn't until year 7 or 8 that we figured that out. And we had basically not taken more than 5 days of vacation for 7 years. And at that point, I just forced Jesse to go on a vacation, basically.
Yeah.
And so we took a 2-week vacation. We went to Japan and we just completely unplugged, and it was really amazing. And then the next year we actually went to Oaxaca. And when you were talking about all of this, man, my mouth is still salivating. It's just so many sauces and everything. I'm thinking of mole, tamales. I'm getting hungry just thinking about it. But I wanted to ask about the idea of methodologyifying something.
Yes.
I think that any good company, once you've developed a certain voice or idea of what you are, you have that verb. Like, what does it mean to lumify something? What does it mean to methodologyify something? Yeah. And that has a real meaning that is hard to describe, really, but everyone in the room knows. What else have you methodologyified?
Yeah, we think about this internally with everything that's on our menu, because a lot of times we'll find a concept out there for a meal. So we might look at some pasta dish that's like trending on Instagram, or, you know, everyone's doing this pasta with burrata, grapefruit, or whatever it is right now. And so Stephen and I, you know, we've gotten to the point where we can look at a recipe and know exactly what changes we need to make so that it's like truly methodology, because our subscribers know what to expect from us. They know that when they come to us, we are going to do, first of all, like the healthiest possible version of it, but make sure it's still tasty. And then second, there's like this presentation factor that they've come to expect from us, where it needs to be colorful. It needs to have a lot of components to it. Our meals aren't really that simple. So like the $10, $12 meals that you get out there, you're just going to get something like, literally, it'll have like chicken breast, a scoop of sweet potato, some green beans, and then maybe a sauce in a container, right? That's not what the methodology meal is. The methodology meal is going to have 7 different components. Each component is going to have like multiple components within that. And because of that, you know, you're going to eat such a diversity of produce and nuts and seeds and all of that. So for us and for our users, they know, like, I want to get to the point where it's super clear when you see a photo of one of our meals on the internet, like, it should just be really clear it's a methodology meal. There's almost like, I always kind of use the word thumbprint. Like, I'll know that we've made it when, like, there's a clear thumbprint when we photograph, when someone photographs our meal, whether it's a customer or whether when we do it, it needs to like clearly be us, where it's like it's comforting, it's familiar, but it's been elevated in that methodology way where there are like smart substitutions that are made. Like we'll take out the burrata cheese and we'll put in like a vegan version of burrata, right? We will put in edible flowers. We're going to find, instead of just using spinach, we're going to try to source like an interesting, maybe like a peppery Asian green that people haven't had before. Those are the kind of swaps that we make because we want to introduce people to new flavors. We want them to eat a wider variety of produce. We want them to minimize eating ingredients that will make them tired or might cause autoimmune health issues. Like that's really what methodologyifying a meal is.
Well, yeah, and that's what I was also, at least visually, thinking about when I was talking about the rainbow. Because in my mind, when I see that thumbnail that you described, I'm seeing some like magenta in there.
Uh-huh.
I'm seeing some purple, lavender yeah. colors and yellow, like bright orange, yolky kind of yellows and stuff. It's just like very colorful.
Yeah.
When it comes to like the flavors in there and the ingredients, are there things that you were trying to bring back from your travels that it was just too hard to source the ingredients? How do you do that logistically? I feel like some of the most interesting things could be hard to find.
Oh my God. Sourcing is one of the hardest parts of this job. There are so many things that we want to put on the menu and then sourcing ends up being the bottleneck for it. So that's a really smart question. So for example, with the chitekle paste, we make our own version in-house, but I am still to this day, I went on that trip in October. I am still working on trying to get the version from Oaxaca sourced so we can use actually that version, the exact version. But to set up the supply chain where we not only get what we want, we know that they're always going to make it the same way each time and then we're going to be able to get it consistently is really, really challenging. And so that problem hasn't been solved yet. So we have our version of it, but I would actually love to use the original version because one, you know, I met the artisans who are making it. A lot of them are like these elderly, adorable Oaxacan people who have literally been making the same paste since they were teenagers. And to me, like the flavors are amazing and I would love to actually be able to support them financially, pay them more than what locals would pay, and then also make our customers happy at the same time. So like long-term, we want to source more and more stuff like directly from places like this. It's just surprising how long it takes to set up the supply chain for it. So
what's on that list aside from the chili oil?
Oh my God, there are so many things. So for another example, surprise avocados. You may not know this, but surprise avocado is a type of avocado that doesn't brown once it's cut.
Oh my gosh.
And I've tested this multiple times. I like cut it open, put it in my fridge, took a photo of it every day, and it was probably like even 14 weeks later, it's still, you know, 14 days later, it still wasn't brown, right? So I was like, so I'm like, okay, this is an avocado we need to start using in our meals because we can actually like slice it up and put it in a garnish. But it's challenging because not only do we need to find a source who can give us enough of it, given the size we're at now, we want to be able to use it year round. So we're probably going to have to line up several farmers. They have to grow it in advance. We have to commit to buying a certain amount. It's just a lot to line up. So surprise avocados are on the list. I mean, I always have a long list. Purslane is one of the highest omega-3 rich plant foods on the planet. It's gorgeous. It tastes delicious. It's nice and crunchy. It's super photogenic. None of our competitors are using it. It's something that I want to get into our meals. It's another example of something that's going to have to be custom grown for us because it's just not something that we can just go, you know, buy from one of our distributors. So like a large part of my job is discovering rare and interesting ingredients and produce and then figuring out supply chains so that we can actually introduce it to the menu. So
are there any examples that you're really proud of that you accomplished that?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there are some really amazing things on our menu right now. So, and I'm hoping to cover a lot of them in videos. Like there's a trout that we use right now from a source called McFarland Springs Trout. Mm-hmm. That is like a highly, highly sustainable fish farmery. So like that level of quality is something that like I'm really, really proud of. We do that through like a partnership with a company that helps us with a lot of sourcing. So their stuff is on our menu a lot and it's not a trout that's like easy to find elsewhere. And the quality of it like literally is like butter. It just melts in your mouth. So like I love when something tastes really good, but is also like really good for the environment and is also really healthy. That's always what we're looking for. And that's why like sourcing is such a hard job for us. So that's something I'm really happy about that's on the menu. And we also have some like very interesting Japanese vinegars on the menu. Mm. And like people don't know this, but I mean, So there's like this trend now in America where you're like, okay, take an apple cider vinegar shot in the morning, which it is. It's very healthy because it's a probiotic food. But in Japan, it's actually very common. They have extremely artisanal vinegars that have been made by these family-run businesses who have been doing it for 100, 150, 200 years, the old-fashioned way, and they use all different kinds of fruit for it. So we have like a fig vinegar. There's like a sweet potato vinegar. And in Japan, they not only use these things for cooking.
Black vinegar type of things?
Yeah, and they just, and they'll just shoot it because it's so healthy. Wow. Right? This is like really common there. So I'm kind of trying to introduce this idea to our customers, which is like, you know, here, there are so many different types of vinegars that are so good for you, so delicious. You can use something besides balsamic vinegar in your salad, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, here, take this fig vinegar. Here, take this purple sweet potato vinegar. And it's like also extremely probiotic. You can also just shoot it anytime. And they're so delicious. You can just literally drink it right out of the bottle.
I think the American palate is, there's so many more wild fermented beers and like sour beers these days. I feel like the in kombucha, the palate is going sour. There's like an interest in sour flavors, I feel like, these days.
No, you're so right. I'm like really happy to see that. Like, I love seeing that Americans are becoming more food forward thanks to all these documentaries that are always coming out on Netflix and other places like that. So much food that's common abroad and extremely healthy and delicious isn't mainstream here yet. And I definitely want Methodology to be a part of that movement that introduces a lot of these things, these storied foods, to Americans, because there's this misperception here that like to eat delicious food, it has to be unhealthy. And that's just totally not true. And like, I really want to erase that idea from people's head. I want them to like come eat our food and be like, wow, that was super satisfying. And it was also good for me. Like, that's kind of why we exist. I want to like change that mindset and make that accessible to people.
There's an overlap between software and food that I think is interesting, in that what's really powerful about software is you can write the code once and then people can use that, you know, infinitely in theory. And a recipe is kind of like that. Like, you put that work up front of developing a recipe, and if it's really great, people could use it for the rest of time. There's got to be a little bit of a tension internally between continuing to introduce this variety and also developing the scale of like, when you put all this work into developing a really great recipe, why not use it as much as possible? How do you figure out when to reintroduce old recipes, or kind of like balancing that tension?
That's a great question. That's a smart question. It's actually one of the trickiest parts of our business, because our business model is a weekly subscription. And so the hardest thing to balance is, okay, you're ordering from us every week. You simultaneously want to make sure that like, you want your favorites again, right? You don't want to just come and every time it's all new things. So balancing like wanting to see your favorites regularly enough, but not too much, but then also wanting to try new things every once in a while. And so, I mean, this is constantly debated on our team, where we try to strike just that right balance. But we know our core user really well, because we're a small enough business that we interact with them a lot. And so we nickname them like, they're creatures of habit, frankly. Like, the kind of person who wants to do meal prep and order from the same service consistently, like, frankly, most of the time wants roughly the same dishes over and over, like their favorites, and then some new stuff sprinkled in. So that's basically how we end up designing the menu for them. But it does create a lot of work. They do want a couple new meals every week, and every single new meal is tons of work. This is why restaurants have fixed menus, because R&D cost is huge. And so figuring it out, and it may or may not work. So then you do all of this work testing it and then launching it, and then people may not like it. You may have gotten it wrong, right? So there's just a lot of cost and risk to it. But we kind of have to do it, because people would fatigue if we never introduce new menu items.
But I think this is such a common problem in a lot of different industries. And the two examples that come to mind are Spotify, where, you know, how do you introduce people to new music? And then on the other side, like the robo-advisors like Wealthfront and Betterment, where there's this dial of risk. Like, are you someone who wants to try something new every week? Or are you someone who wants to be like consistent and I have my favorites and I just want the same? And I know you have a little bit of personalization kind of in the platform when you're starting to answer the questions about your personal preferences. And you also adapt to a lot of different types of diets, whether it's like vegan or paleo, etc. How much customization do you have, or do you want to have?
Yeah, we software has helped us a lot in this case with customization, because people are super particular and have, yeah, they're really different. There are people who, like, every time there's something new on the menu, they want that, right? And then there are people who there are specific dishes that they love, and even if it's on the menu literally every week, they still want it every week. So we first do customize the diet, especially with foods to avoid. I think that's one of the key features of our product, just because one of the things I learned from my own personal experience is there are certain foods that make certain people sick. And sometimes these foods are healthy for one person, but makes another person sick. So just by figuring out what foods make you personally sick and avoiding them is one of the biggest things you can do to dramatically change your health. So we allow our users to add anything that they can't eat to a foods to avoid section in their account settings, and then make sure that, you know, whenever a food has one of those ingredients, like, they never get assigned that item. I do, because I believe it's, like, that important. You know, for example, for me, like...
And can you just set any... Can I just put bananas in there? I mean, I love bananas, but can I... You can put anything you want in there?
Yeah, And if it's not listed, then they can email us, and then we can add it on the back end. But pretty much everything's listed, because so many things have come up. You know, we've been around over 5 years now, so you'll have people list, like... You know, there are people who say stuff like, I don't like pork, but I like bacon. You know, so people get pretty specific in a way that cracks me up.
That just sounds like personal taste is more so than like a like physical problem.
They definitely, quote unquote, abuse the system for their personal preferences. But that's fine. You know, we want them to love everything they get. So whether it's for a health issue or just their palate, they're able to use the foods to avoid feature in that way.
Is there a feature where you can just say, add bacon to everything?
Oh my God, that's ingenious. I will add to the backlog. I will talk to the engineers about that. Okay. We don't have that yet, but people would love that.
That might be popular.
I feel like I've been telling my co-founder, I've been wanting for a while, like, I feel like people just want to be able to add an egg to everything. That's like the trendiest thing now. I told them, like, just to be able to add a fried egg to most meals is something people would really value. But apparently we can't do fried eggs at scale at our size. So,
but I know this is also very personal for you, because that was one of the sources of inspiration, was just from a health perspective, you were feeling not just busy with your work, but also that you were having, you know, trouble with the foods that you're eating. And I think that it feels so mysterious in some ways. I don't know how your specific body responds to certain foods. I don't know where we are in the science around this, but it feels like it's so personal. And I don't know how people go about figuring out, just among all of the hundreds and thousands of ingredients that there are, which ones don't work for them.
Yeah, it's completely personal. And thankfully, there are more and more awesome functional medicine doctors popping up who can help work with you on it. But even when you go work with one of these doctors, and some of them are like very expensive concierge doctors, the process is basically the same. They'll have you take a blood test, and that test will give you some hints about some issues you may be having. But in the end, like, even once you have that list, the best way to really find out is to do like a full elimination diet, which is so painful, but like, it's really the only way to truly know. And it takes a long time to do it thoroughly. So it's an example, like with dairy, I stopped eating dairy because I didn't know this, but you know, once I stopped eating dairy, and it took about 4 to 6 months, my skin finally cleared up with the acne that I was dealing with, but it took that many months. So like, think about how many people remove dairy for a week or two and they're like, oh, I feel the same. And then they give up. Right. So that's one of the reasons why it's so tricky. It's just a lot of the foods that you're exposing yourself to, you have to really remove them for a long time before you really see and feel a difference. And I think that's why a lot of people, I mean, it makes me sad. And that's one of the reasons why I started this business. They suffer with health issues on an everyday basis, whether it's like really intense symptoms for seasonal allergies, asthma, acne, anxiety, fatigue, and they don't know it. And it may be caused by a food that they're constantly exposing themselves to, even though they just think it's part of everyday life. But unfortunately, to your point, figuring it out is really hard, and it's a lot of work because it does require going on a strict elimination diet for many, many months.
One thing I've noticed in your videos is you've got a lot of great tableware. There's a lot of dishes and things, and I'm like, where'd you get that? We're seeing some imagery of your background of your kitchen, or I'm not sure where you are in these different videos, but What's your interior design philosophy? Where are you getting these great plates and things?
Yeah, it all ties into my obsession with, maybe this is because I'm an extreme homebody and introvert. Like, I like my home environment to be like really soothing and a place where I can feel like peaceful and creative, and I work from home. And so, yeah, I really labor over everything that's in my house. And also, I think a more sustainable way to live is to just really only buy things that I truly, truly treasure. And so I'm minimalist. And then when I do choose to buy something, it's something that I know I want to have the rest of my life. And so, like, I spend a lot of time shopping for and picking out like tableware, whether it's, you know, the forks or the plates or the bowls that you see. And a lot of them I've purchased on my travels in Asia, which is why I feel bad when people on Instagram ask me, like, where's that wooden spoon from? I was like, I don't know. I got it somewhere in Bali. Like,
wow.
I can't really help them. But they're things that I treasure and that, like, I will literally use until it completely falls apart. And so, yeah, I think that the things that you see on the Instagram feed are nice. It's because, like, one, I appreciate things that are designed and built, like, truly artisanally. And two, like, you know, I don't want to cycle through a bunch of, like, trashy stuff that I throw away because I'm sick of it after a year. Like, everything that I own in my kitchen, on my tabletop, I mean, it's the kind of thing that, like, I hope to pass off to someone someday because it's, like, really a treasure.
And also, we didn't cover this, but the glass jars that I don't think anybody else is really doing it that way in the food delivery. But I think that it just ties into the whole experience being, I don't know, kind of feeling cohesive. Where did that come from?
Yeah, no one is doing it, and because of the economics of it, you would,
right? It's breakable. It's heavy. There's a lot of downsides to it for sure.
Yeah,
on the other hand, it's plastic free. It's reusable. Glass is infinitely recyclable. It has a lot of benefits as well.
Yeah, exactly. And the idea came from, like, I mean, there are just so many reasons why it's a better option. It's one, it's better for the environment. Two, it keeps food fresh longer, right? That airtight jar. And three, I want people to have this feeling that, like, our food really is the same quality and same kind of ingredients as homemade food. And so I really wanted to look homemade. I wanted the packaging to look kind of homemade. It looks homemade in the sense that if your grandmother or great grandmother were, like, canning something, right, like making jam,
right. She'd
put it in the same jar. So it looks homemade in that sense, but it's a bit modern in the sense that, like, we can print on it. We have these, like, matte colored pink lids to make it a little bit fun. So that part of the design aesthetic is kind of similar to how I do my house. It's like always like a little bit like, I like things to be modern, but I like to kind of wink at tradition because I still have deep respect for everything related to tradition, how food was traditionally made, how products and art used to be made by artisans. And like when we were not wasteful as a society and like would keep things for a whole lifetime and pass it from one person to another. So I just feel like the glass jars, they made a lot of sense for our business and all the things that we value. Like we wanted to put the food front and center. We wanted it to stay fresh. We wanted it to have that homemade feeling. And even though it's expensive as hell and really hard on the supply chain, of course the supply chain team hates me for it because they're like, I make their lives harder. But in the end, we just have to do what aligns with our values and what we know is best for our customers. And so we just do it. And we go after customers who are willing to pay a premium for that experience.
You mentioned being a homebody and introvert, you are working this year on making friends. How's that going, especially with COVID?
Yeah, I was on such a roll before COVID. I had been doing a great job of working from coffee shops, introducing myself to strangers. And I don't think that I've made any new friends since COVID, come to think of it. Like, it's been an interesting time. Like, I feel like maybe other people are doing the same. I feel like I've doubled down on my very close existing network, like the closest friends. And I now talk to them even more. We're really good now about jumping on FaceTime or Zoom every 1 or 2 weeks. And maybe, you know, we probably never did that before. And then I have like my two friends in LA who I see really, really regularly. We do social distancing takeout together like several times a week where we eat in a parking lot 6 feet apart. And that's like the only social interaction I get all week. So yeah.
If you need a buddy to go to some of these like high-end takeout restaurants, I'm in. So
no, if you're serious, I will include you. You have to be careful what you ask for because I like love bringing people out to eat. That's my favorite thing.
No, I'm serious.
So we'll do it. But you have to be okay with me putting you on Instagram.
Sure. I'll be 6 feet away.
Yeah, we'll be 6 feet away. I'll bring you one of the masks my mom hand sewed. She sewed so many. I've been like giving them out to our customers and to all my friends. So I'll bring you one of those. You'll be safe. And yeah, we'll all pick something. I have a long list.
Joking aside, though, what was the inspiration for that kind of like resolution to go out and try to make more friends? And before this all happened, like, what was your approach to it?
One of the reasons why I moved down to LA was my co-founder and I had a chat in January of 2019, and we just said, like, okay, what are the biggest opportunities for the business this year? And one of the things on the table was like, okay, we really need to figure out food media. And that was one of the reasons why I moved to LA, because it's a huge food media scene here. Mm. And so I realized that after living here for 6 months, I really hadn't made a lot of progress with my networking in that space and just networking in general, because I had moved to LA and spent a lot of time just working in my house and like not meeting people. And so I realized like, okay, there's a huge cost to the business for me being down here and not up there. And that cost isn't worth it if I'm not actually building a network down here that's actually going to help us crack the code to food media. So yeah, so I ended up making a resolution at the beginning of the year, like, okay, I'm like really going to go out and try to meet a couple new people every week and then meet who they know and really build a network here, which I hadn't had to build a network from scratch in a long time, because I went to Stanford, stayed up north, and just had this built-in network that I knew from over a decade that just kept growing. And yeah, I found myself in LA. I had one friend and she was my cousin. I was like, okay, I'm not doing a good job here. Like, this cousin isn't going to help me figure out how Methodology will someday have a food TV show. So I'm going to have to really be intentional about it. And then that's where that came from.
When I first moved to LA, for a while, I had a roommate. She was my best roommate that I ever had. And she was this 60-year-old woman who was just like a badass. She was a camera operator and she worked on Iron Chef. She was like one of the main camera operators on Iron Chef and several Food Network shows. And so she would, in the way they would produce the seasons, she would go travel either to New York or she would do it in LA. And she would bring back at the end of the day all of the ingredients that were not used, because you know how they do the Iron Chef? It's like, the secret ingredient.
God.
So whatever was fresh from that day was like open season to the crew to grab and bring back. And then at the end of the shoot, you know, it would be like 3 weeks long, all the pantry items were up for grabs, everything that was not. So I ended up with so many weird ingredients that I would, and she didn't, she was like, she had a very extreme diet, so she never ate any of that stuff. But I would have like a whole rabbit with like the skin on and everything. And I was like, okay, I'm going to have to figure out how to skin a rabbit today. And that was such a fun time. And she was amazing.
I love so many things about that story. I don't even know where to begin. I'm literally stuttering, but I love that you had a roommate like that. It's just, you would never expect it from someone your age, especially.
Yeah. And the best part was that I had been watching for my whole life, like Good Eats and Alton Brown. And mm-hmm. she got me like a pass to come on the set and meet him. And it was really fun.
Oh,
yeah, that was a great time.
That's so cool. You're making me want a roommate now.
Yeah, I think this is a bad time for roommates, but when everything blows over, you should have a roommate who's who works at the Food Network, and I think it'll be an in on a lot of things. I can definitely see the Methodology show. I could totally imagine it.
I'm glad. I appreciate your vote of confidence, and that will be a fun Craigslist ad for me to write when I'm ready for a roommate.
I think I could keep talking to you for hours, and maybe we will over some random foods in the parking lot. But if people want to, while they're in confinement, try some great food, where should we send them?
Go to our website at www.gomethodology.com. That's the only way to sign up. And yeah, we're taking new customers, deliver all throughout California, the greater Seattle area, and Portland.
And the Instagram is also amazing. If anyone's listening and enjoyed hearing you, I think that the stories, there's a whole backlog now of stuff that you can explore from all of your travels and things. And I've been enjoying those tremendously. So I hope people go check those out as well. That's also Go Methodology, right? Or is it just Methodology?
Yeah. That's right. It's Go Methodology. We weren't able to get Methodology
really?
Anywhere.
Oh, okay. Well, it's just Go Methodology then. But it's the first one that pops up. So mm-hmm. that's what matters.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. It was really fun to have you on, Julie.
Thank you for having me. I had a blast. Let's eat soon.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.